Back on Monday, we started with Earth Day. And today, instead of our usual weekly news roundup, we're going to hear from environmental reporters to get their thoughts on how we're doing. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks, as always, for being part of our program. And we'd like it if you could join us on Twitter. We're at Full Story WSHU. All right, since Monday, we've talked about the environment and the big and small issues and challenges that we're all facing. Today, we're going to bring in some reporters who cover these stories on a daily basis, and we're going to start with Erica Chirino. Erica grew up on Long Island and became a global environmental reporter. She's now a guest researcher at Roskilde University in Copenhagen, Denmark. And most of the time, we talk with guests right here in our studio, or at least they join us on the phone from their office. But today we have a new one. Erica's office is a boat. It's a first for us, and I hope not the last. Hi, Erica. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Ron. Thank you for having me.
Erica, where are you?
I am in Iceland, off of Iceland, in the waters off of a really large schooner called Opal. It's a sailing boat that's being used now to do various ocean expeditions, studying microplastic, whale health, and other issues like that.
Wow. Please thank your captain for us. Our producers told me that you're joining us on Skype, and he put the boat in position for you to do that?
Kind of. We were just watching a giant sperm whale off of the bow of our ship, and so now I had to kind of fiddle with the internet and make it work, but now it is functioning for now. Fingers crossed.
That's awesome. So you're whale watching. You have a different life than I do. You're a Long Island native. We're wrapping up Earth Week. What are your thoughts about the environmental directions that we're heading in nowadays? Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic?
I've actually been really heartened by the recent efforts in Suffolk County. That's where I'm from, born and raised in Suffolk County, to kind of reduce pollution, raise awareness about environmental issues, and also clean up contaminated sites. Of course, we have a long way to go, but I think we are definitely going in a very positive direction.
Now, you mentioned plastics right at the very beginning. You're saying that's one of the things that you're researching while you're off the waters of Iceland nowadays. Someone said to me the other day, plastics, overall amount of junk that we're dumping nowadays. And they said, look, are we concentrating on the small stuff nowadays when it's really the big stuff that's going to kill us?
Well, the plastic issue right now is an issue that's becoming bigger and bigger as the pieces of plastic our environment get smaller and smaller. And harder to see. So I would say that this is an issue that is only going to continue growing. But ironically, the pieces of plastic that probably are threatening us most are small in size.
That's interesting, because it's as we get rid of, and we're all conscious, and we're all about the plastic bottles, the plastic cans, and so on. You're saying it's a tiny thing. Someone even said to me the other day, you know, you have to be careful about your contact lenses, the ones that you throw away. Even that could be damaging.
Yes. Yes. So, for example, out here in the ocean, we see a lot of whales being entangled by plastic fishing gear and other big pieces of plastic trash like bags and bottles. They sometimes eat them and get sick. But the issue with all pieces of plastic, no matter what the size, is that over time, due to just their natural breakup in the environment, is that they become smaller and smaller without ever decomposing like organic matter would. So all the plastic that's ever been made still exists. It's just that it's been broken up into very small pieces. So that is the issue, basically.
So you're in Europe. You're currently based in Denmark, to be
currently
precise.
And
you're currently floating off of Iceland. How do you compare what the Europeans are doing to what's going on in the United States? Are they way ahead of us? Are they way behind? Or are we about equal?
I have to say the efforts are very disparate. We see a lot of efforts, just like in the States, with localities and municipalities working on certain efforts. So there are really no blanket rules that are governing plastic pollution. We're working towards that. So the EU this year actually made kind of a commitment to reducing plastic in the natural environment, specifically in the oceans. So there are kind of, you know, there's talk to reduce plastic, but the action is limited, and also the action is very localized. So we're talking from country to country, city to city, that kind of thing. So I'd say it very much mirrors what's going on in the U.S. And if you look around the natural environment in Europe, you know, it's just as polluted as the U.S., even more polluted in some places. So this is a global issue, and until we all get on board on the same global level, it's not.
So it's with your background, I have to ask you, what are your thoughts about the Green New Deal?
So I think that we have a lot of politics going on, environmental politics, that we're working towards these solutions. How do we kind of make a new way forward? I think that it's really important to address climate change and also like the economics behind it, which the New Deal would address. But I think maybe we need to start in a more simple way. And I think the local method of changing things is it's making some kind of impact, but we need this global agreement. So not just in the U.S., but everywhere. So I'm kind of skeptical about it, I would say.
So just to clarify it for a bit, you think that it sounds like a good idea, but look, if you just do it here in the U.S. without worldwide cooperation, it may not amount to much.
Exactly. We need to be thinking globally and not just on a national level. I think that like we really need to address the issues by speaking internationally at the big summits and bringing in scientists, bringing in stakeholders, which is every one of us. So putting everyone on the table, not just people from the U.S.
What are we missing nowadays when we talk about the environment and our future? I tend to think that we're covering most of the major issues, but I know when I speak with reporters and experts such as yourself, that they always tell me something that I don't know. What is it that we're not talking about?
We're not talking about how, again, these disparate efforts to change the environment for the better are not really working fast enough. So it can be really nice to go out, for example, and see efforts to increase recycling rates or efforts to clean up beaches. But to get to the heart of the issue, we need to address kind of a larger cultural problem. And that's rooted in our overconsumption of pretty much all materials on Earth and also natural resources. And this is a global scale again. So if we just talk about local efforts to do small things like recycling more or cleaning up beaches and whatnot, we're not really going to make the impact that we would need to make in order to preserve the environment enough for all beings on Earth, not just humans. So we're talking about the whales out here that we're watching today, birds, and you know, even algae and bacteria. Is like we're really changing the whole structure of the way the Earth works. So we have to stop thinking so small and start thinking much larger and making drastic efforts in the way that we live.
Erica, it's interesting that you bring that up, because just yesterday on our program, we had a program that we called it Green versus Green. And one of the aspects of the show was about recycling, because for a long time it was, please recycle more. Let's do this. And recently I've been noticing more and more people have been saying, okay, recycling is good, but you know what? Just consume less and take care of it that way. Don't throw stuff out. Be aware of what you're buying so you don't have to recycle it.
Yeah. I mean, you can do that, because it's almost impossible to go to the grocery store today if you have a budget of a normal working class person and get food that's, you know, wrapped in glass or wrapped in metal or not wrapped at all. You would have to seek specialized shops, which there are more and more of them today, but often they're out of the budget of many working class people. So yes, recycling is good if you have to buy food purchased in plastic or any other kind of recyclable packaging. But yes, we have to consume less. And I think part of that involves making the effort to slow down and think about what we are doing and what we are buying. And if there are solutions to get our material items elsewhere or in a different way. So, for example, bringing your own reusable container to the grocery store, if you can fill it up, for example, in the vegetable section, putting things in reusable bags instead of wrapping them in plastic, just thinking ahead rather than thinking afterwards, which is what recycling basically is that you buy something and then you can treat the material in a way that is what we think very positive, you know, reusing it. But if we just don't use it at all, it's a much better way to keep it out of the natural environment and also to reduce our reliance on that material.
Erica, one last question. We had a program just the other day about the explosion over the next few years of wind farms. And since you're a Long Island native, it's going to be off the southern coast of Long Island. It's going to be in the Atlantic Ocean. Since you're spending time nowadays in Denmark, what are the thoughts there for wind farms and reusable and renewable energy?
Wind farms are very prolific in Denmark and also in many other parts of Europe. It's a really available resource, the wind. Also, I want to mention solar is also quite available. But yeah, wind farms, they are popping up everywhere, it seems, in Europe. I think that they could be a great way to add renewable energy to our energy mix. It's not the only answer, obviously. We need a mix of different types of energy to keep the grid reliable and also perhaps make a more intelligent grid where energy is stored instead of wasted, and more people could use more kind of, I want to say, innovative ideas for storing electricity, like using electric cars as batteries. I've heard of that idea tossed around in Europe. So in short, yes, I would say that wind farms, in my opinion, are a good idea. Of course, it would require environmental planning and analysis before we place them to make sure it's not impacting any species that could be harmed by their presence.
Erica Chirino, Long Island native, global environmental reporter with Scientific American, Vice, The Atlantic, and a lot more. Currently stationed in Copenhagen, Denmark, as a guest researcher. Thank you, Erica. Enjoy watching the whales. We appreciate your time today. And once again, please thank the captain for us.
Yes, thank you, Ron. Take care.
Take care. This is The Full Story on WSHU. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're going to continue talking about the environment in our region, and we're going to do that in just a moment from now with Carl Grossman. But first, let me tell you about Monday's show. As you well know, the country is continuing to fight the opioid epidemic. There are many municipal and state officials who are going after many of the manufacturers and the doctors and the pharmacies involved in the manufacturing and sale of the opioids. One of the companies is based in Stamford, Connecticut, Purdue Pharma. It's owned by the Sackler family. Connecticut's Attorney General is William Tong. His office has made numerous allegations against Purdue and the Sacklers, allegations that they are denying. William Tong will be our guest, our main guest, one of the guests on The Full Story on Monday. Now, back to our current show as we wrap up Earth Week. Today's show, naturally, it's about the environment. Carl Grossman is a reporter who's covered environmental issues on Long Island in our region, I think, for about 60 years now. He has two TV programs, Environment Long Island, and also he's the host of the program Enviro Close Up with Carl Grossman, and he writes the column Suffolk Close Up, and he's a professor of journalism at SUNY Old Westbury, and in his spare time, he sleeps. Carl? Carl, thanks for being on the show today.
A pleasure to be with you.
That's a heck of a resume. Carl, you've been doing it, like I said, 60 years. What's the number one environmental issue facing Long Island today?
Today, it's the issue of what to do with wastewater, whether it should be recharged into the aquifer below. And Long Island is dependent on the aquifer below. It's one of the regions in the U.S. Denoted by the federal government as a sole source aquifer region. And all the water we drink, all the water we use is under our feet. But what's occurred in recent decades is that sewers have been built, and the wastewater in those sewer systems has been sent out to bays and out into the ocean. And my great concern is that this will result in a drying up of creeks and streams and a lowering of lakes. In fact, that's what's occurred in next door to us is Nassau County on Long Island, next to Suffolk County. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that government on Long Island has to commit itself fully to recharging, fully treating the wastewater. It's called tertiary treatment. and sending it back into the aquifer, into the groundwater.
So clean it up before you put it back in.
Right, and don't just let it be sent out to sea, out to the ocean, because that's going to, I mean, ultimately, it's all we have, the water below our feet, and we have to preserve it and keep that quantity constant.
I know I have a number of topics I want to get to you, I want to get you to talk about, so I'm going to kind of barrel through some of these things to get your take on it. How concerned are you that Connecticut says the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant, just obviously across the sound from you, is going to keep operating for another 10 years?
I'm very concerned. Nuclear plants were never designed and never considered to run for more than 40 years. After 40 years, this was the thinking, components would become hit with radiation through the decades. Metals would become embrittled. After 40 years, forget it. But what's occurred is that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has given extensions of licenses now to 60 years. They're talking 80 years. In fact, there's even consideration 100 years. And not only are they extending the operational time of these nuclear power plants, but they're operating them. They're having them run hotter and producing more electricity. And, frankly, a disaster is being asked for. And in terms of Millstone, that's been a problem-plagued plant for years, way before the extension of its operating time. In fact, I did a TV show regarding to Millstone maybe 30, 35 years ago, and I was sitting there on Pleasure Beach, just right next to the plants, with one of the many whistleblowers. More than 60 whistleblowers have come forward in regard to Millstone. And the Challenger had just blown up, and this particular whistleblower talked about having at his home a photo of the astronauts who were on the Challenger. And suddenly the guy I was interviewing about Millstone, he started crying. And he started saying that sooner or later, there's going to be a disaster involving this nuclear plant. And if there is a disaster, it'll affect deeply. I mean, think what happened at Chernobyl and Fukushima. It'll affect deeply people in Connecticut and right across the Sound here, folks on Long Island.
And talking about nuclear power plants, just to step back in time, you mentioned how you were talking about this 30 to 35 years ago. It wasn't too far back that there were actually proposals to build, if I got the number right, 7 to 11 nuclear power plants on Long Island?
Yes, 7 to 11. In fact, I write a book about that. It's called Power Crazy, because of the sheer number, how that begins this scheme. Con Edison wanted to build a nuclear plant in the middle of New York City in Ravenswood in Queens, a geographic center of New York. The claim from the folks then of the Atomic Energy Commission is that that's okay. We can engineer safeguards. Finally, because of grassroots action in New York City, that plant, Ravenswood 1, was stopped. And in the vacuum created by No Ravenswood, the Long Island Lighting Company, partnering with Brookhaven National Laboratory, that's a national nuclear laboratory here on Long Island, put together a plan to build many nuclear power plants on Long Island. Shoreham would be the first, and there would be two more at Shoreham, Shoreham 1, 2, and 3, east along the Long Island Sound, and again, right across from Connecticut, would be four nuclear plants, the Jamesport nuclear plants, and there'd be several in between. And then also being considered was a nuclear plant on the South Shore in Bridgehampton, in the Hamptons. Mm. It was decades of, again, grassroots action, political action on the state and county level. And finally, that scheme was stopped. And Shoreham, which was completed, and in fact, it went through low-power testing, but never went into commercial operation, was blocked from going into commercial operation. And it sits there, a hulk of all its nuclear innards have been removed, but it sits there, again, right across from Connecticut on the north shore of Long Island, abandoned as a nuclear facility.
I don't want to spend too much more time on it, but I think there are some proposals to turn it into a park.
Well, there was some concern about what's going to happen to the property around the old Shoreham nuke. And at this point, what's occurred is that preservation is going to be the goal, which is sure better than a nuclear power plant at Shoreham.
Carl, wind farms are going to be in the Atlantic in a big way in the next few years. What are your thoughts on them?
I think they're great. I mean, I went out to Block Island on a boat. That's where the first of these wind turbines have been erected. And honestly, they're beautiful. I mean, if they were a little smaller, they could be exhibits in the Museum of Modern Art. The blades turn very slowly. So, I mean, this contradicts the claim that birds can get kicked. I mean, years ago when the blades of wind turbines went very quickly, there were bird kills, but now they move very, very slowly. They don't take up much space. I mean, fishing people are concerned about fishing. I don't think that really should be a concern. They can provide off Long Island, and in fact, off many, the Europeans have been doing it, particularly the Germans and the Danes. Also, in Britain, we have a lot of wind farms. It's a carbon-free, safe, green way to generate electricity, and I just think it's fine.
What about the concerns of the fishing community?
Well, I'm very sympathetic to the concerns of the fishing community, considering how they've been pushed around, how here off Long Island there's been these foreign trawlers that come and all but vacuum the sea. And I mean, the fishing people have had tough times, but I think that they could coexist as they've coexisted in Europe with offshore wind.
Carl, obviously these wind farms will benefit many of the states, Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and then they're talking about expanding them straight down. So we're all working together. But I know that you're concerned that New York and Connecticut have not been working together for a number of years.
Well, the thing is that actually environmentalists from Connecticut and environmentalists from Long Island had at one point worked closely together fighting this nuclear scheme. Groups from Connecticut, in fact, it's in this my book, Power Crazy, about how several environmental groups from Connecticut joined with Long Island organizations and challenged in atomic energy. That was then the Atomic Energy Commission, replaced by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, proceedings. And since then, there's not been enough, I don't believe, coordination, working together, cooperation between Long Island and Connecticut, and there should be, because but you take the Long Island Sound, I mean it's beyond a common resource between us. It's a treasure between us, and stuff that happens in the Long Island Sound, the depositing of dredge spoils in the Long Island Sound, things that affect the Long Island Sound affect Long Island and affect Connecticut, but neighbors, and I think together, we could be more powerful than operating alone.
We're talking with Carl Grossman. We have about another 5-6 minutes with him. Carl, what do you think about the Green New Deal?
I think it's great. I think it's great because, I mean, the huge threat that we're facing is climate change. And how do you deal with climate change? I mean, there's a discussion that we got to retreat from the coast and so forth. We have to attack the cause. And the cause is the burning of fossil fuels in automobiles and trucks and power plants. This is the key reason for climate change, for global warming. And in terms of we along the coast in Connecticut and on Long Island, which is surrounded by shoreline, by coast, we really have to, I think, all join together and get at climate change through, again, the cause. And what's available now is, well, the alternatives to these sources of fossil fuel burning, they're here today. Electric cars are here today and should be encouraged. Solar power. I mean, I'm sitting speaking to you in a house in Sag Harbor on Long Island. On my roof, it's an old salt box, over a century old, a south-facing roof, 38 solar panels. I mean, it's. I walk out the door even on a cloudy day, and you can see the meters, because the panels feed into the grid, going backwards because those panels are generating more electricity than our house needs. Tidal power is, think of, again, between Connecticut and Long Island, Plum Gut, that force of the of tidal change through Plum Gut. It's off Orient Point, enormous. I mean, that can be harnessed, that power can be harnessed. Indeed, there's a company that has put some experimental generators off Roosevelt Island, in the East River, just off Manhattan. It's going to put 60 now generators in the East River. Wave power around the world. Wave power has been something that has been seen as a source of clean, green energy. Energy is not going to kill us like nuclear power, and energy that could eliminate this enormous threat of climate change.
I remember talking to proponents of hydroelectric 30, 40 years ago, who said, look, I don't get it. I don't know why the states aren't pushing for this. It's here. It's easy. And like you said, it's safe. Carl, you were talking about waters. And the waters are rising. The shorelines in our region are going to change in the next few years. Those are the predictions, and I believe them. Are homeowners ready? I mean, do planning officials realize the severity of the problem that's already happening?
Well, particularly on Long Island, more so than Connecticut, there are many homeowners who are oblivious to living in shifting sands on the ocean. I mean, 150 years ago, 100 years ago, old-timers on Long Island wouldn't think of building a house on the coastline. Again, on our coastline along the ocean, which is shifting sands. They'd build a beach house, but they would regard it as something that would probably be expendable. A big storm could wipe it. So they didn't build along the shore. But now you can go along, well, Dune Road in West Hampton and other places along the south shore of Long Island. And these, I don't want to sound critical, but these plywood paradises of these beach houses built in the teeth of the ocean are there's one after another, and then these folks want the public in the wake of any kind of storm, and storms are
to bail them out,
and now they're getting worse to bail them out. A lot of people on Long Island, these beach house owners, don't get it.
Carl, 1 minute left. Tell us an environmental story that we really don't talk about that's been on your mind, and maybe we should be talking about it.
Let me go back to the story which really started me off on doing environmental journalism and combining it with investigative reporting, and that was the plan by a public works czar here in New York, Robert Moses, to build a four-lane highway the length of a beautiful barrier beach, Fire Island. And I did journalism on this story after story, and between my journalism and particularly the grassroots action, the effort by environmentalists and other citizens to create a Fire Island National Seashore, that highway project was stopped. That just shows you can fight City Hall, no matter what City Hall will tell us. And I think on all these issues, what we need, we can't count on the government officials, the politicians. We have to have more grassroots action regards to the environment, whether it comes has to do with outfall of wastewater, or whether it has to do with those millstone plants, the two of them, which are a deadly danger, in my view, to life in Connecticut and life on Long Island. So the message I would like to leave people with is act, move, in terms of nuclear. That was an old motto.
We have 5 seconds, Carl.
Action. Yeah.
Carl Grossman, investigative environmental reporter and professor of journalism at SUNY Old Westbury. Carl, thank you.
A pleasure.
We'll talk with you soon. It's The Full Story on WSHU. You're listening to WSHU's The Full Story. I'm Ron Ropiak, and normally on Friday, we do the weekly news roundup, and we're going to get back to that next week. But considering this has been Earth Week, we thought we'd change it up just a bit. We still have reporters on the air, but we're concentrating on the environment. Our final guest today, this week, is Jan Ellen Spiegel. Jan has been with us in the studio before. Jan is a freelance reporter, and you can find many of her stories nowadays at ctmirror.org. Jan, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be back.
When you talk with environmental leaders, when you talk with state officials, what are they telling you about the number one environmental issue facing Connecticut? What would it be?
Well, I think you have to look at climate change from its broadest perspective. Would have to encompass a whole lot of different things. And with that comes quite a bit of energy policy for the state and, you know, how you make that energy policy into reality, given various costs and given the general finances of the state.
I don't know if you were able to hear the first portion of our program today with Erica Chirino. And she was saying basically, look, it's great what's going on nowadays, but many communities, many regions are kind of doing their own thing. And I think her take on it was we have to think bigger, think globally to tackle this. As someone who's covering the news in Connecticut and interviewing all the leaders, is there a big plan, so to speak?
Well, ideally, what you will hear from everyone is these sorts of things should be tackled from a national perspective. And I think it's pretty clear that that's not going to happen under the current administration. And therefore, most everything has fallen back to the states or to regions, especially in New England, where you can do things a little bit more easily on a regional basis because the states are smaller. You know, not only that, you're faced with having to deal with stuff that's already on the books, maybe at a national perspective or something that affects your state directly, that the Trump administration is actively trying to roll back or diminish in some way. So you're kind of stuck with two things. If you want to get anything done as a state or a region, you have to do it on your own. Plus, you have to spend a certain amount of bandwidth dealing what was already on the books that may be in jeopardy. You know, classic case of that right now would be things like the auto emissions and mileage standards that the Trump administration is trying to roll back for motor vehicles. The state of Connecticut, most of the states in the region have some of the strictest controls on what they're trying to keep in place. And so you're trying to clean up your air through motor vehicle emissions and other things, and you're trying to actively fight the Trump administration that's trying to diminish these. So you can be pretty busy on that front.
So if I'm reading it right, you're trying to be progressive, move forward, do the best things for your citizens. At the same time, you're fighting your own federal government.
That would pretty much be the case right now, yes.
The news came out just the other day that the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant, if it gets all the approvals from the state, will keep operating for another 10 years. As someone who's been following this for quite some time, can you tell us what is the background as to why this is happening?
Well, that's a slight mischaracterization. The Millstone Nuclear Power Plant is both units, units two and three, are licensed to operate through, I think it's 2035 and 2045. The issue for the state of Connecticut was the owners of Millstone Dominion essentially complaining that they could not compete with lower priced natural gas. And if they didn't get some sort of subsidy, some sort of supplemental something or other, as many plants around the country have done the same thing, not being able to compete with lower priced natural gas, they're going to have to shut down sooner. Never mind carbon footprints or anything. Millstone does account for about half the power in the state, close to a third of the power in the region. We've got the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant in Massachusetts that's shutting down later this year. And the only other operating plant in the region right now is Seabrook. Vermont Yankee closed a few years ago. So it was really partly an economics issue, partly a clean, if not renewable, energy issue. You can dispute how clean a nuclear plant is on multiple levels, but the actual power generated, you can argue, is carbon-free. So it was that issue of economics. How do you keep Millstone operating, which theoretically is going to hold prices at a more reasonable level and will allow the state of Connecticut presumably to meet its various carbon-free levels that it's trying to meet and greenhouse gas emissions levels that it's trying to meet. Millstone was allowed to compete. There was Sturm und Drang over this for 3 years with Dominion not showing their books, so the state couldn't really figure out how bad the economics were. They finally revealed some of it. Bottom line, Millstone was allowed to compete with other carbon-free entities, and it was awarded a very large piece of that competition. What transpired after that happened, which was the very end of last year, was a kind of a breakdown in negotiating the actual power purchase between Millstone and the state's two utilities, Eversource and Avangrid. And that's where the issue came in. And they finally reached an agreement. I think most people thought that they probably would reach an agreement. And of course, they did, to basically keep operating, to basically have buyers for their power. The agreement that was reached through the state's competition basically gave them a contract to operate for 10 years. The first 5 years of that would be just as a normal plant based on the cost of the power. The second 5 years put it in what's called an at-risk category, that it might be in danger of shutting down because it couldn't compete economically with some of the other factors. So that's what we have now. Millstone will be, and I have to say, Seabrook also, just on its own merits, won part of that contract too. What was disappointing when this was a request for proposals, when this RFP result was announced, was that the bulk of it, 82% of it, more than 82% of it, went to nuclear power. So a lot of the environmental advocacy groups were very, very disappointed that more didn't go to solar, more didn't go to onshore wind coming in from Maine and other places, more didn't go for offshore wind, which, well, we've as a state, as Connecticut as a state is buying into offshore wind, it is not doing it at the levels of the other states in the region. So that's kind of a mouthful there of what's going on.
No, it's an excellent explanation, and I appreciate it. Just so I can clarify and understand it a little bit more, how long will Millstone still be operating? Till what year?
I believe unit one closed years ago. So there's the remaining units, two and three. Two, I believe, is 2035. And I believe unit three is 2045. But they can shut down in 10 years. I mean, they can there's a mechanism where they can essentially buy, well, they've entered into a power purchase agreement for 10 years. So theoretically, they're going to honor that. As a plant, something could happen. They could shut down at any old time. Look, there are nuclear plants sitting on the coast of New England, as is Pilgrim, as is Seabrook. All of them are absolutely vulnerable to sea level rise and any other issues related to climate change. One must be mindful of that. Water did go into some of the buildings in Millstone during, I believe, both Irene and Sandy. So stuff can happen that is outside, you know, the control of a power purchase agreement.
You mentioned wind power. New York Governor Cuomo has been very forthright, I believe, in saying this is a good chunk of our future. And I think we'll be hearing a lot more in the next few weeks about the wind farms, which will be off the southern coast of Long Island. What is Connecticut doing? What is Connecticut proposing for that?
Well, let me back up a half a second. I mean, the real leader in offshore wind was Massachusetts that got way out there ahead of everyone. The federal government has leased out massive tracts off the entire Northeast coast. And we're talking Maryland, Delaware, all the way up close to Maine. And Massachusetts was really the first state to issue a mandate for a certain amount of wind power, 1,600 megawatts. Then they added another 1,600, so that's 3,200 megawatts. New Jersey, with a new governor a couple of years ago, replaced a Democrat replacing Chris Christie, had a mandate for 3,500 megawatts. New York doesn't have a mandate, but it has a goal that has since reached something like 9,000 megawatts. Maryland has a mandate. Connecticut, and these mandates are for at least X amount of power. Connecticut has been a little slower go here in that we don't have a mandate. We have at this point agreed to, I believe it's 300 megawatts of power on one of these plots. And there's a lot of push in the legislature right now to up that to an actual mandate and an actual mandate for 2,000 megawatts. There are those who think that's too much within the administration. And if we're going to have a mandate, it should be 1,000 megawatts. That is a purchase of the power. The other piece of the whole offshore wind industry, which of course is massive in Europe. I mean, Denmark is the world leader in offshore wind. What one of the big prizes is here beyond the absolutely, you know, renewable clean power is the onshore industry. There is no supply chain for offshore wind in the U.S. This would be the first location for it. Massachusetts, because it got out there so early, of course, won a lot of goodwill through that for getting a lot of the industry cited there. The state of Connecticut already has a bit of an agreement for the Port of New London to use it as a staging area. It's a very good port for that purpose. There is a sense that that states kind of have to pay to play. If you're going to buy the power, then you'll get some of the onshore industry. And there's a lot of concern, especially given the economics in Connecticut and given the job climate in Connecticut, that we're not doing enough to make sure we get some of that onshore business. And this has been discussed for several years now.
And in Connecticut, as you point out, they're talking, well, it appears to be New London. And in Massachusetts, if I'm thinking back, New Bedford?
New Bedford has already built its facility. It's already been used as a staging area for that very small offshore wind farm off Block Island. It has a major wind testing facility up in Boston, and it's already I haven't checked in lately, but there are a number of operations that are underway there. New York is bargaining for this as well. I believe Port Jefferson recently had a big proposal there. New London has a couple of big things going for it. Number one, it's a deep water port. Number two, it doesn't have any overhead barriers. Number three, it doesn't have a hurricane barrier in there that, you know, makes it a little harder to maneuver ships. Number four, it's already got a big boat, you know, shipbuilding industry, and because of electric boat and because of the sub base. So there's a lot of security in that. Those are things that make New London a pretty good place. It's a little further because, remember, all this offshore wind stuff is in federal waters, which is at least 6 miles out, which is why you're never going to see offshore wind in Long Island Sound. Number one, it's only state waters, New York and Connecticut. Number two, Long Island Sound's just not windy enough. The thing you have to remember about offshore wind is it is not what they call intermittent, like solar, where, you know, solar, nighttime, there's no power. Onshore wind, it's intermittent. Sometimes there's no wind. Offshore wind is what they call variable, which mm-hmm. means it always blows. You always have offshore wind. It may be at different levels, but you will really never have a point where those turbines aren't moving.
If you're a sailor, you never want to hit the doldrums. Jan, I have one and a half minutes left. What are the bills, that one or two bills that we really should keep an eye on in the next month or so for the Connecticut legislature concerning the environment?
Well, I would say one would be how some of the parameters for solar get restructured a bit. Based on some legislation last year that made some folks pretty unhappy. They're working on that now, how to compensate solar owners for the power that they put back into the grid. There's a lot of discussion over that. There's discussion over this offshore wind, whether to set a mandate. There's stuff related to electric vehicles. There is the plastic bag legislation and whether that's really going to get built out into something that's a little more broad-based than it came out of committee. There is a Green New Deal legislation, which is now called the New Green Economy. I don't know what language is in it, but it's under negotiation.
There's a lot going on, and it's all going to hit over probably the next 5-6 weeks or so. Jan Ellen Spiegel, she reports on energy, the environment, food, agriculture. Nowadays, a lot for ctmirror.org, right?
That's true.
Jan, always a pleasure. Thank you. I appreciate it, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, and you're welcome.
Thanks, Jan. That's going to do it for our show today. We had a wonderful week talking about the environment. I learned a lot. To be honest, I hope you did too. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Have a good weekend. Thanks to all of you for being part of the full story. Stanford-based Purdue Pharma is fighting numerous lawsuits connected to the opioid epidemic. Now, Connecticut State Attorney General William Tong has expanded the fight, alleging that the company has transferred billions of dollars to the family that runs Purdue Pharma, the Sacklers. William Tong is our guest next time on The Full Story.